From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Robbie Feinberg with the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, November 1st, 2023.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering crawl space repairs and waterproofing. EasternBasements.com.
Court documents released late Tuesday afternoon by the Maine Attorney General's office offer new details on why the suspect in last week's shootings may have targeted a bar and bowling alley in Lewiston. An affidavit filed by the Maine State Police says that suspect Robert Card believed there was a conspiracy against him and that his family and area businesses were accusing him of being a pedophile. He believed that four area businesses were spreading the accusations online, including Spare Time Recreation and Chemenghi's Bar and Grill in Lewiston, where he shot and killed 18 people and injured 13. He also believed Gowell's Market in Litchfield and Mixer's Nightclub in Sebattis were complicit. The affidavit also says Card had been delusional since February after a bad breakup. He reportedly had significant weight loss, was hospitalized for mental health issues, and had stopped taking his medication. According to Card's brother, whose name was redacted in the affidavit, Card had met his former partner at a cornhole competition at Chemenghi's. Democratic Governor Janet Mills announced on Wednesday that she plans to create an independent commission to discover and review the facts leading up to and after the worst mass shooting in Maine history. Steve Missler has more.
The governor said in a statement that the commission will probe how the gunman who killed 18 people and wounded more than a dozen others was able to carry out the shootings despite multiple warnings from family, law enforcement, and his colleagues in the Army Reserves that his mental health was deteriorating. Mills said the commission will be independent of the after-action report that will be performed by the Maine State Police. While the membership of the commission is not yet known, Mills said that it will be created in consultation with the Maine Attorney General's office and that it will be comprised of legal, investigative, and mental health experts. More details are expected to be announced next week. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
To mark the one-week anniversary of the shootings in Lewiston, the city declared today an Act of Kindness and Gratitude Day. Residents were encouraged to offer small acts of kindness, things as simple as helping a neighbor with trash, giving a compliment, or letting someone cut in line. Patty White has more.
For Ivan and Rosemarie Lazur of Lewiston, the acts of kindness started early in the morning.
Oh, when we're coming out of church, people are looking at each other and smiling.
Lazur says they were familiar faces, but not people the couple typically talk to.
It was just unusual.
The Lazurs plan to continue the kindness with a visit to a family member Wednesday and phone calls to friends. Denise Charest of Lewiston decided to pick up chocolates to deliver to a friend's workplace.
I have someone that has done things for me in the past, and I want to surprise them today with a little something to make them feel special.
Some acts of kindness began even before the official day was declared by the city. Jenna Gigi is owner of Blue Jay Coffee near Central Maine Medical Center.
We have a gift card for first responders and healthcare workers that we've been using for, you know, anybody who works for the city or works for Central Maine or St. Mary's.
Gigi says customers have been continually adding money to the gift card. And on the official Act of Kindness Day, a patron gave her a couple pieces of candy. Another customer bought hot coffees to hand out to people who are unhoused. But Gigi says those acts aren't unusual.
I mean, it feels good. We actually are really lucky that people tend to perform a lot of acts of kindness, I feel like, in this community already. So in a lot of ways, I feel like it's kind of like a normal part of life here, which is really cool.
A few blocks away at Simona's hot dog stand, co-owner Linda Simona says for the past week, people have been buying meals for each other and stepping up in other ways.
All of our customers, it doesn't matter what walk of life, and they're just hugging people they don't know, police officers, you know, the mayor, everybody. And just that feeling of wanting people to know that they care, that there's still connection.
That message has come through to people who responded to the shooting, says Paul Gosselin, executive director of United Ambulance in Lewiston. In the days since, he says they've received notes of gratitude and gifts of food.
I just think the whole point of them thinking about us and their actions are meaningful. It's not the food or anything like that. It's the thought that counts, and we're very appreciative of them thinking of us at this time.
Lewiston City Administrator Heather Hunter says the goal of the Act of Kindness and Gratitude Day is to spread hope and positivity. And she says it will be an annual event unless it's no longer needed.
What I hope for is if we do this frequently enough and we message this enough, it's not a special day, it becomes every day.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
On this one-week anniversary of the mass shootings, we're bringing you stories of two of the 18 people who lost their lives that night. 40-year-old Peyton Brewer Ross was among those who died at Shemangi's Bar in Lewiston. Family members and friends say he could talk for hours about comic books, and he was always on the lookout for a good cornhole tournament. And those close to him say that Brewer Ross had been in the early days of settling down as a shipbuilder, a partner, and a new father. Nicola Grisco reports.
Peyton Brewer Ross had a colorful wardrobe. He had a large Superman tattoo on his arm and a collection of T-shirts with his favorite wrestler, Macho Man Randy Savage, on the front. Then there was the Randy Savage red jacket, complete with a cheetah pattern and long, multicolored tassels hanging from the sleeves. Ralph Wellman Brewer recalls his younger brother showing up to a gathering at the family's camp on Cabasee Lake with the jacket on. If there was anyone who could pull off the look, Brewer Wellman says, it was Peyton.
He was a character. He would make people laugh. And it was the way that he was able to tell stories. And you could hear the story. It could be 100 times, but each time he told it, there was something else that you could pull out of it.
Brewer Ross had always enjoyed wrestling, comic books, and playing cornhole, but Wellman Brewer says that it was in recent years that his brother's life as a partner, a father, and a professional shipbuilder had started to take shape.
He got everything lined up, early, 20s and even in your 30s, sometimes it's hard to figure out what it is that you want to do in life. He did many different jobs, moving and storage. He owned his own bread route, delivering bread. That was just, until he figured out what he wanted to do.
5 years ago, Brewer Ross started work at Bath Iron Works and graduated from an apprenticeship program last year as a pipe fitter. Rebecca Wolfenden met Brewer Ross on the first day of that program.
We started our class with three pipe fitters and three women. And by the end of it, he was the only pipe fitter left and I was the only woman left in our class. So he always used to make the joke that we were the Highlanders.
Brewer Ross was determined to complete the program. And Wolfenden says he was often the first to arrive for his shift or for study time.
If he had a goal in mind, if he said that he was going to do something, there was no way that anybody or anything was going to stop him.
He tried to better himself. He did better himself by, getting in there and doing it, taking the bull by the horns and making something, for him and Rachel, his fiance.
Peyton and Rachel had been together for 15 years, and the couple had wanted to buy a house for the two of them and their daughter, Elle, who turned 2 years old last month.
He really loved being a dad and was really looking forward to settling down and, growing up, not just being the goofball who, was down for whatever, but, actually being the grown up with the good job and the partner and the family and all of that.
In fact, Wellman Brewer says his brother had been talking about cutting back on his cornhole tournaments so he could spend more time at home with his family. And for the last few weeks, he hadn't gone to play at all. His car had been in the shop for repairs, but it was returned to him last Wednesday afternoon, hours before he would drive to Shemangi's later that night for the usual tournament. His brother, Ralph Wellman Brewer, says Peyton's loss has been difficult and confusing for Elle, who had been learning to toss the cornhole bags with her dad in the yard.
Because she doesn't understand, and, she wakes up and it's like, where's daddy? And, daddy's not there.
Volunteers from the local BIW union were at the shipyard gates Wednesday to collect donations for Brewer Ross's family, which has also started a GoFundMe page. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Legrisco.
40-year-old Brian McFarlane was also killed at Chemangi's last Wednesday. McFarlane was one of four members of the state's deaf community who had come to play cornhole that night and were killed in the shootings. He had worked for years as a trucker, a career laden with obstacles for deaf people, and had only recently moved back to Maine at the urging of family. Carrie Brooks says it wasn't surprising that her brother Brian became a trucker. She remembers McFarlane playing with matchbox cars and trucks as a kid. Like her brother, Brooks is deaf. In text messages, she says that the family moved to Maine from Louisiana when he was only 2 years old. His mother would later remarry, which brought Brian and his sister under the same roof with two new step-siblings.
He really was the brother that I never had.
Tony Randazzo says that at first, he and his new stepbrother struggled to communicate because of Brian's deafness. But Randazzo says they found a way to connect by exploring the city of Portland, venturing out into forests and other nooks.
And he would often say to me, hey, come here. And we'd hop on the bikes and we'd go off into, we lived right next to Baxter Woods. So we would go in there and he'd show me something in there. And then we'd cross Stevens Avenue onto Evergreen Cemetery. We explore that, and sometimes we go to places that even I don't know where they are to this day.
Family members say Brian would leave Maine in his 20s for Vermont, where his sister and mom were living. It was there that he completed what he described as one of his greatest life achievements, obtaining his commercial driver's license. Federal agencies require a hearing test in order to receive a CDL, but rules were changed about a decade ago, allowing drivers who are deaf or hard of hearing to receive a waiver. Carrie Brooks says many driving schools refuse to accept deaf students, but she says Brian pressed on. A truck driving school owner agreed to accept him, and an interpreter was provided to help him with the training. After a lot of work and the help of vocational rehab, Brooks says her brother became the first deaf person in Vermont to receive a commercial driver's license. Randazzo says it was a point of pride for Brian and the whole family.
And that's what he wanted to do. And I was so proud when he became a truck driver and I heard that he was the first deaf truck driver to get a CDL in Vermont. And I was just so proud of him and somewhat jealous because, in a way, I'd kind of love to be a truck driver and see the world, you know. I was just so happy for him that he did that.
McFarlane worked for several different trucking companies and moved back to Maine this summer at the encouragement of his family.
And he jumped at that opportunity and came up here and got plugged into the deaf community right away, where they went on, where he did the weekly cornhole tournaments at Schmeggy's. And he was on his way to the next step in his life and his career.
Randazzo says the safety and community was part of why the family encouraged Brian to come back to Maine, making his death in last week's shooting even more difficult to process.
We told him he was going to have a great life in Maine, and this is a safe place for him to come. And for that to happen, it's like we lied to him in a sense. But how could anything like this have been predicted? How can you imagine something like this would happen? You know, you're that what should be a safe place to play a game with friends and to connect with friends in one of the safest cities in the country, in the world. And no one can even imagine that this person is going to choose that bar at this place and this date.
In the wake of the tragedy, McFarlane's family is raising money to help cover expenses, but also to create a scholarship in McFarlane's name for a deaf student who wants to pursue a career in the trades. The city of Lewiston expects to open a community resilience center by the end of the week with services to help victims, families, witnesses, and first responders affected by the mass shooting a week ago. Carol Bousquet has more.
City councilors Wednesday morning voted unanimously in an emergency meeting to direct City Administrator Heather Hunter to apply for grant funding to cover the costs of therapy dogs, overtime, and other emergency support services provided by nonprofits since last week's shooting. Hunter says the funding would also cover a new community resiliency center with services for victims, families, witnesses, and first responders for up to 27 months.
It's long-term. It's based upon victims, witnesses, and the community's needs, you know, not only immediate as we transition, but to get through the holiday season, to get through 6 months, depending on what their grieving pattern is.
Hunter says Community Concepts will run the Resiliency Center. Tri-County Mental Health is currently using therapy dogs and counseling to support organizations who need help now. Hunter says nonprofits do not have the money to cover these emergency expenses, so the city will also seek funding to reimburse them. The Community Resiliency Center will be located at 184 Main Street in Lewiston in the former PECS and L.L. Bean Call Center. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Carol Bousquet.
In other news, state and city workers have cleared what had become Portland's largest homeless encampment. Wednesday was the fourth time that an encampment had been removed within the last 5 months in the city. Outreach workers said the Maine Department of Transportation, which owns the park and ride lot where several dozen tents had been pitched, allowed them to arrive early before bringing in bulldozers and dump trucks to clear the space. Some unhoused residents had already left the site, but others, including Paul Hooper, were still weighing their options.
I got out of prison in December, and I had a voucher, and I couldn't find any place to live because the set limit was way below the housing prices. So I couldn't find a place within the allotted time that I had for the voucher limit. And so that made me homeless.
Hooper says he won't go to the city-run shelter because he's worried about storing his belongings there. He says he'll probably move to the encampment that's formed at Harborview Memorial Park under the Casco Bay Bridge on Commercial Street. That site has grown in recent weeks, and a Portland City spokesperson says that it will be the next focus of the encampment crisis response team and could be cleared later this month. The Penobscot Nation and Trust for Public Land today announced a plan to return nearly 30,000 forested acres in Maine back to the governance of the tribe. The land represents a portion of what was taken from them in the 1800s. Susan Sharon has more.
The land near the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument is well forested, previously managed for industrial timber. It also contains more than 4,000 acres of wetlands and 53 miles of streams and rivers in the Penobscot River watershed. This is part of a larger area that is sacred to tribal culture and community.
It's reconnecting us to that traditional territory, you know, in a way. We're not getting that treaty land back, but we're at least, you know, getting closer.
Chuck Loring is the director of natural resources for the Penobscot Nation, who says he's excited about stewarding wildlife habitat for bear, moose, and for salmon. Because of the parcel's size, elevation, and biological diversity, Loring says it will also be important for mitigating the effects of climate change. The Trust for Public Lands secured loans to purchase the property as an interim owner last year and is now working with the Penobscot Nation to raise $32 million to pay them off. In a written statement, TPL said the move aligns with its commitment to support tribal nations and indigenous communities in their efforts to recover, restore, and protect their ancestral homelands. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock on Thursday morning, we'll highlight the variety of performing arts happening throughout the holiday season. I'm Robbie Feinberg. Thanks for listening.